welcome to a Listen to Older Voices Golden Moments program. I'm brought to you through the Toorak Times. This is a repeat program from our archives that we believe has merit enough to rebroadcast so that the story and the person's life can be shared with those who may have missed it the first time. Rob Greaves here once again, and it's a pleasure to have you with me as we rejoin Kate Kennedy for part two of the three-part story of her life. Born in 1925, Kate and her family were caught up in the Great Depression. Her father, a musician, lost his job and the family lost their home. But they survived intact. Kate does have a good education and makes the most of her opportunities. She's sharp and learns through observation and from experiencing life to its fullest. When World War II comes, she finds herself working in a munitions factory. This week, we learn about how she enters the world of publishing, a career that she keeps for life. We also learn how she meets Ron Kennedy, her husband-to-be. Kate also openly shares her philosophies on life and religion, but it's not all serious as she talks about her social life, especially the importance of social dancing. Kate also shares family stories freely. Now, many listeners will know of Mark Kennedy, possibly Australia's best-known drummer, and Kate gives us a snapshot, if not an insight, into her life as Mark took up his drumming career. So many stories, so let's make a start with Kate talking about entering publishing.
Now, when I got there, the man who had edited the Australian Hardware Journal had been seconded to that department too. So I worked with him then for the remainder of the years, which was of the war years, which would probably be about 4 years.
Well, that's long enough to get to know somebody.
He went then back to his job and said to me, would you come and work with me?
Right.
So that's, by that time, I was much older than you would normally go into publishing. So I turned 20 by then.
That's right, yes. And so you went into publishing, which was obviously something you really enjoyed.
Oh, yes. I had an incredible life, really, from that point on. I worked with Crawford for years. And even the story of the Hardware Journal was romantic.
Please, tell the story.
It was wonderful. Well, it was an offshoot of a British ironmonger. Mm-hmm. And they decided the new colony was such a long way away that what was happening in England was maybe not as much interest in this one that was just really at the birth of its development. And they sent two of their people out there with their agreement. They said, would you like to go to Australia and set up a publication there? So off they went, which took them approximately 3 months to get to Australia. And they started here, and it was called the Australasian Ironmonger and Engineering, because the British paper was the ironmonger.
Yes.
And so they set that up here. And after a few years, wouldn't happen today, but with the lapse of time and communication, which became almost impossible, the British company said to the boys, look, it's too difficult, it's yours. So they were handed that, though they had to put no money in it. But when they sold, of course, money came in.
Oh, of course.
So then it went on. And when I went there, then there were three directors, Morris Candy, Henry Edmund, and I never, ever knew Miss Neville's name.
Just Miss Neville.
She was Miss Neville. But they also started one, the Draper of Australasia. She was in charge of the draper, and the other two were with the hardware.
What was your job when you first started?
When I first went there, it was just as an assistant, but with the advertising, booking, and, you know, I was never on the clerical side.
Mm-hmm.
I was always involved in that. And then they had Crawford Norton came in as editor, and he went back to it, and I was working with him.
Right.
Until they decided that they wanted to get out, and Crawford left. He was a bit disappointed that I stayed after he left.
Why would he have been so disappointed?
I think he was disappointed that the business was sold, and I think the whole terms of the place changed completely.
Sure. How long did you stay with that company?
I stayed until because eventually I met Ron through the church because, you know, we were reared with the church.
He was the man who became your husband. Mm. Yes. Yeah.
I was there until I was about 25 and I was expecting my first child. So I was there for that 5 years and stayed home from that point on and finished up with 2 more babies and rearing my family until one day Crawford was still there at this stage. Ron met him on the train. He lived down at Brighton, and we were in Elsternwick. He got in the same carriage as Crawford. He said, asked what I was doing, and he said, well, I'm just home with the kids, you know. Mm. And he said, would you be interested in coming back to work? I just can't find anyone that I would really like to have it back. And he said, oh, we'd have to see what we could do at home with 3 children. Mm. It was a bit difficult. They were all at school by this time they were all at school. And he said, look, could she work from home? And he said, we'll see if we can do that. But we found out it was not possible. By this time I'd had to look after my mum because she'd been very ill, so she came to live with us. So the arrangement was she'd look after the kids till I got home, and I finished work at that stage at 3 o'clock. So I could get home in time.
So that was a workable arrangement.
Yeah, it was quite a workable arrangement until eventually, of course, they were off my hands and it was full time. Crawford left, another editor came in, and when he went, I became editor. So it was, just went on.
Just happening.
Yeah.
I would like to follow your adventures as editor, but before I do that, could we just go back a little bit, back to you meeting Ron. How did that actually happen?
Oh, well, that was, we lived in Trevelyan Street, Elsternwick. And he lived in Brighton, and we all went to St Catherine's Church, and we were all in the young people's groups. And they had a family of boys, and his 2 older brothers and sister were all with us in the same group.
Right.
And he was younger than those. He had 1 younger brother who didn't come into this at that time. And so, we'd all do things together, and he went off to the Air Force. That was rather funny too, a thing that had never happened that I know before. He was called up at 18 and in the army. He said he wanted to go to the Air Force, and they said, yeah, that was okay. So when he went along to the recruitment to sign his papers, they said, date of birth, he said 19th of September. And they said, no, that's not right, 21st of September, because they had all the people to call up. He said, no, that's 21st. He said, no, the 19th. He said, no. They found out his father had told them all their lives that he was born on the 19th.
It was the 21st.
It was the 21st.
Oh, years of celebrating your birthday on
the wrong day.
Thanks, Dad.
For 18 years.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, that was quite a funny one. So I still, the Kennedy boys, still had a lot of time. We used to go to all the local dances. We had one at St Catherine's, then we went to Holy Trinity Balaclava. We went to St Luke's North Brighton, and then we had 1 night on our hands, so we went to the Masonic in Garden Vale. So we danced every Saturday night, and because Ron was away, and bit by bit all the boys went, and when he came back, just somehow we gravitated together.
Right. Dances were a really big social.
Well, it
thing,
was big
they?
Because there were no nightclubs.
That's right.
Only the naughty people went to those
nice
sort
clubs
of
clubs anyway.
Those
that's
sort of
right.
Places. And that was the way you did entertain yourselves.
Yes.
And our whole life was around the church.
It had a different importance than it has today, doesn't it? It really was like a social binding.
Oh, it was. Yes.
Yeah. And it seems to have either lost it or people don't look for it anymore. I'm not quite sure.
Well, I think that they don't. And I've heard a lot of people, in even as we were rearing our children, who decided that they didn't want their children to go to... we'll leave it until they can make up their mind. And my argument was, they can't make up their mind if they know nothing about it. And it's the same. You wouldn't say that to your child, well, you can go to school later on if you feel you want to go, but if you don't want to go, it doesn't matter.
It's true.
Well, you can't say that. They know that they have to go. And I always believed if the children, strayed away from that, well, at least they had the choice and they had that background.
Mm.
But I believe they needed that choice.
Did you do that with your children?
Mm.
Yes.
They all went. All of my children were baptised at the same church that we were married, and you know, went to Sunday school, and
yes.
And I've got one precious. Well, Claire will kill me for telling you this, but I had one precious piece. You know, every Sunday they'd get a sticker for attendance.
That's
and,
right.
And she had this book, and the stickers went in, and she they were told they could make a cover, and she had all these holy pictures on the front of it. And a little message that said, God loved me very much, but if I'm bad, he don't like me at all. And I've still got that. I think
great.
It's just so precious.
That is incredibly precious. Yeah. Those sort of little family memorabilia my parents and their parents kept. And they, people don't seem to do that anymore.
Oh, I've kept all the notes she wrote
it's
me.
Amazing.
You know, funny thing. Yes. And there was one girl who used to really get her go to school and called Naomi. And no matter what happened, Naomi would be better than everyone else. She was the best scholar. And you know, and she said, Mum, this note she wrote me, I was working at this stage at night, some trade show. Mum, I have to take 70 cents tomorrow to go on the trip. I am very lucky. Even Naomi didn't get to go.
Oh, pinnacle
yeah,
of achievement. Yes, right. Glory be.
Yeah, all, but I've kept all of those notes.
Yes.
Listen to older voices. The magic of memories. I'm Rob Greaves, and I'm talking with Kate Kennedy.
We moved through the 50s into the 60s, and many people I've interviewed from your generation found themselves getting a little bit lost with all the changes in the 60s. But you had a different thing going on in your family, didn't you? You had a,
yes.
Things had a different importance to you.
Well, see, my brothers came home, the ones that had gone to the war, and they married, and one brother lived at home, you know, with his wife. Things got a bit difficult for Mum. She had two of them without homes, without money. What happened with the boys that were in for 6 years? From 18 to 24, there was no work experience.
No.
You know, so they came in cold. Everything they did up to that point was cut off.
Yes.
It was very difficult time for them. There's no money. They had no earning capacity.
No, that's
and
right.
So they had to start. And, of course, They got married. The mum had lost the home, dad lost the home. They were renting a little place in Elstonwick, and Mum came to live with me, and the two married couples lived in the house then.
And when you married Ron, were you able to set up your own home, or did you live with your parents?
Oh no, I never lived with my parents, but right. My parents had to come and live with me.
They came and lived with
no, you. Not my parents. I didn't tell you about that. No, just after my brothers had come home. My father, of course, had been a musician, and there was very little work for him. Mum went to work, and Dad stayed home and looked after us and got what work he could. And eventually, Dad, in his day, had been quite well educated, and he was a choir boy at Christchurch Grammar School.
Right.
So that was wonderful for him, and he'd had that basic religious upbringing. And he finally became verger of St Mary's Caulfield.
Goodness me.
Yeah. So Dad and Mum stayed in that house until like the remainder of the war.
Right.
The boys had just come home, and Brother Ron was living away from home by that time. And my younger brother Lance, he was living with us. And he was the night before Dad's birthday. We were all waiting for him to come home, and he didn't come home. And Mum was getting very worried. It was getting very late. Dad didn't come home. And she said, well, you better go over to the church and see what he's doing. And he was dead on the floor.
Oh, what a shock.
He'd collapsed and died, yeah.
Oh, goodness me.
Mum was only 53 at the time. But I don't really feel that she picked herself up as well as she could, because I know when I got to that age, nothing would have stopped me.
I have a theory that with each generation, they do get a little bit stronger and a little bit more dominant, and maybe you just inherited, you know, developed a little bit more than she had. And yes. But it's even so, it must have been a shock for her.
That, oh, yeah.
It was an awful thing to find.
Mm.
Your children. You had two sons and a daughter?
Two sons and a daughter.
Daughter. Which was the first child?
Mark.
Mark is the first child. And then?
Ross.
Ross and Claire.
And then
Claire
was the young one.
Right. Mark, for people listening who may not realise it, Mark is probably still considered as Australia's top drummer. And certainly has played with anybody and everybody worth naming. Do you think he got that from his
Look, I don't really know. He probably did get it from Dad. His mum was a very nice little pianist. She didn't do anything professionally, but we had a kitchen stool, and it had a lino top, which had a really nice sound about it if you tapped it. And he started playing the drum with a couple of knives when he was about 5 years old.
Right.
Yeah. So. It's been, he never ever wanted to do anything else but drum. I hoped he wouldn't be a musician.
All mothers think that.
Well, mainly because of my experience with my father.
Even today.
If I hadn't had that experience, I might have said, oh, my son's a musician. But I hope he doesn't. And I hope he doesn't play the drum. So I said, okay, you have to learn music. If you're going to be a professional drummer, anyone can fiddle with a couple of drumsticks. I don't care who it is. If you've got any rhythm in you at all, you can. But if you're going to read music, if you're going to be a drummer. So we had a piano. My grandmother had given it. And she, I had a lovely lady in a neighbour who we met, you know, through the church. Miss Brown. The three maiden ladies lived around the corner in a beautiful Victorian home, and she taught music. And I went round to see her, and I told her that I wanted Mark to learn the piano because he had to have some theory and be able to read music. So from then on, he hated it. He really didn't want to do it at all. But I said, well, no talk about being a drummer if you can't read music. So later on one day he made my life complete when he said, best insurance policy you could have taken out for me.
Right. It must have been a little bit noisy at times around the family home, the drumming.
It's a strange thing. Although I don't hear it at all now. Have to play.
No.
Yes, when I was working and he was in the throes of blossoming as a drummer, I'd think, I hope his foot goes through the drum, through the bass drum this morning, you know, while I'm under the shower. But it's an amazing thing. You'd have the boys in the front room, which would be, say, like that.
Yes.
And probably the end of the family room. There'd be two bedrooms between us. And I couldn't stand it. I'd go and sit in there with them and... It was great. It was just that, it was that distance did something, but I could sit amidst the boys.
And that was fine. And that was okay?
You're
allowed to do that?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay. Not a lot of old mums are allowed into the rehearsals.
I had an interest in it, didn't I?
you most certainly did. You most certainly did. Has that led to any interesting stories for you in your life as a result of Mark's, outstanding skill and where he took his
One of the lovely things that happened to me one night in at the Southern, was it the Southern Cross Hotel?
Mm, yeah. Yes.
And Doug Parkinson was singing that night, and it was a Mitre 10 night. I think they were giving out some sort of awards. The details of it now are a bit... Done.
Yeah.
Anyway, I went up and spoke to Doug because I knew him well, and the usual hug and a kiss, and Dad and I went back to dance, and all of a sudden Doug had changed the words of the song he was singing and saying, lovely to see you tonight, Mr. was a thrill.
Chuffed on that one, yes, of course.
But it was amazing. So many times Mark would say, I'll be in Melbourne on such and such a day, and say, sorry, love, I'll be in Sydney and I'll wave to you over Albury. Our planes will pass.
Because it's all very well to talk about Mark's career, but your career was really blossoming then, wasn't it?
Oh,
you were a really busy woman. Would you like to fill us a little in about that?
Yes, it was very, very... I mean, in the beginning of my time as editor, things were still pretty tough financially. it was just a struggling company that had been sold a second time, and every penny counted.
Mm-hmm.
And every subscription that came in to our journal,
it was valuable, yes.
I'd race down to the bank and put it in, you know. It was, that might be like exaggerating, that, yes. But it was.
No, no.
It was really pretty tough. So you were a jack of all trades. You did everything. You
had to.
Really had to turn, you know, turn things in. And I would work very late, sometimes weekends. When I was doing a lot more field work, I'd take it home. The family would go to bed and I'd lock myself. I was able to lock myself in the kitchen. That was the one room I could close myself up, and I could work there then. But it was very hectic. And I always used to laugh at people and say, oh, get your secretary to do that. There was no secretary.
You were it.
I was it. I typed my own letters. I did everything.
Yeah. And that's a very interesting word you just used then, type, because during this period, of course, there's none of the wonderful technology, was there?
No.
It was really hands-on stuff.
Oh, yeah, it was. And we would paste up the layout, and that we did one thing, which was called a buyer's guide. And they might still be doing it. But we'd have the galleys of type, and they'd run them off for me. I'd have these great strips of stuff.
Mm.
And the correction would come in and you'd cut out a line of type and paste it in. That would take hours.
Oh, yes.
You think what they do on the computer today.
Yes, that's right.
Mm.
And you've tuned into Listen to Older Voices, featuring the life and times of older Australians.
Where did your career go in publishing? At this stage, when we're talking about, you're really pretty close to Iron Man Band. You're having to do just about everything yourself.
Mm.
When did it start paying off and you were able to start not having to do all the nitty-gritties?
I think it started to pay off quite a while after. Now, I remember so vividly the first year that by this time there were three directors. The printing company and Charles Henderson, who became the editor after Crawford Norton, they bought the company out. And the original company was called Trade Press, because
mm-hmm.
they were able to do the ladies' journal, you know, the Traver mm-hmm. journal mm-hmm. as well, because that included fashion as
yes.
well. But then when Charles bought it, it was only the Hardware Journal. The Draper had died by then.
Oh, okay.
Drapers were going out of fashion anyway.
That's right,
you know,
yes.
And so it became, you know, the Hardware Publishing.
Right. Mm.
And then it was sold again and it became Glenvale Publications. And that was because the printing company was out at Glenvale Quartal, whatever it is, out at Mulgrave.
Right.
And so they thought, oh, well, we'll use the name Glenvale. So, and to this day, it's still the same. Yeah, Glenvale. So yes. I was sold each time with the.
So how long did you stay in publishing?
That time, I stayed until I was 60. And I went back probably 18 years.
That's quite a slug of your life.
But it was lovely. And look, I had the most wonderful time with people. The men were so courteous to me and treated me beautifully. I could never complain. And I look back now and see all the ladies that are in the field, whereas I was a loner in those days.
Oh, yes.
I would go to a big conference and the chairman would get up and say, lady and gentlemen.
At least he acknowledged you.
Mm.
Because of
Always.
Always,
yes. Yes, it was very interesting. You know, later on, I had the opportunity to travel a lot with it.
Overseas or within?
Oh, it's overseas. When Mitre 10, you know, there's just so much history involved in what I did. I saw the birth of all of these groups, the buying groups, the Hammer Hardware, Mitre 10, Thrifty Link, all of these
yes.
groups that came into being, because originally it had been all the wholesale companies, you know, John Danks, the hardware company, Briscoe, Southern Wholesale. They were the wholesalers. They imported and then sold.
And sold it on, yes.
So then you had these groups forming. And I was at the launch of quite a lot of those
were at their birth, as you said, the birth of
all of these people were called together to hear what had been devised by the various people with Hammer Hardware. That was Southern Wholesale. They brought all their customers together and said, well, this is what we'll do. If you group buy, we're going to be better off.
Yes.
So, you know, I saw this happening right around the country and right around the industry.
So where did your work take you overseas?
I think my first one might have been with Mitre 10. And they were having I went to their national conference because they were looking for the publicity.
Of course.
To get more members for their group. So, and then later on with John Dank. So I went as the trade reporter mm-hmm. for those things. And eventually, because I was editor, they went into the journal. We took, you know, they would probably get a 4-6 page feature, whatever was, you know, warranted with that. I think the first one, we went to Singapore. That's right, they were having their conference in Singapore, and you could get the conference was in Perth. Everything was paid for you to go to Perth, and if you wanted to take advantage of the holiday and go, you could. So I did that.
Absolutely.
So that was my first one, but after that, I went with them as one of their members. We went to Hawaii and we did all the states, you know, Tasmania, we did New Zealand.
Join Kate and I for the final part of a story, including her attending trade missions overseas, her volunteer work in hospitals, and the untimely death of her beloved husband, Ron. There's so much more to Kate's story, so do join us next week on Listen to Older Voices for the final part of the story of Kate Kennedy. Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program. Listen to Older Voices is supported by financial assistance from the Commonwealth Government through the Commonwealth Home Support Program and is podcast to you through the Toorak Times and TAG.